You've landed Inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Welcome, everybody. You all know me. I'm Tamara, the host of Inside Launch Street podcast, the creator of the Innovation Quotient Edge Assessment, author of Innovation is Everybody's Business book, and host of the Everyday Innovators Online Academy. I feel like there's a theme when I should just be like, I'm Tamara and I'm for innovation for everybody. Like, that's what it boils down to. I'm really excited for our guest today, Brian. I'm going to let him introduce himself. Before I do that, I just want to give some context as to why I invited him on and kind of where he came from. So Brian and I actually met doing a panel for innovation for the, is it the AIM Institute? I think yes. I got that right. A wonderful organization that brings tech into communities. And I really was blown away by Brian's responses. And as you all know, that doesn't often happen. I tend to tune out when other people look. I've never been there, right, Brian? But Brian had some really interesting things around not just culture of innovation, but how to build cultures of experimentation, which I know for us in our community is really important. So Brian, I'll let you introduce yourself. Tell everyone a little bit about you and welcome.
Absolutely. Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate you having me on the show. My name is Brian Ardinger. My day job is I'm director of innovation at Nelnet, a publicly traded company, probably most known for student loans. So if you've paid a student loan, you may have seen our envelopes before. But we're also in solar. We just launched Nelnet Bank. So we're in a lot of different areas. My job at Nelnet is director of innovation, which encompasses both the inside and outside part of innovation. I do a lot of startup investing we don't have a venture fund per se, but we do a lot of venture investing in the startup space. And then the other hat I wear there is the inside innovation, helping build our culture of innovation across our different business units. And then the other time that I'm not spending with Nelnet is I created something called InsideOutside.io, which is a weekly podcast, a weekly newsletter, and an event series that we've been doing for the last 4 years that brings together innovators and entrepreneurs and folks that are interested in this space and the new world of work and the new world that we're living in. So that's a little bit about me.
All right, Brian, I have so many questions already just from what you said in your intro. So let me just, before I dig in, let me just back up and again say to those of us in the online academy that have the privilege of listening to this podcast live before it even goes out on the air able to ask questions and comments, put them in the chat bar at any time. And I will get to them as best I can as we're going along. All right. You know, I wanted to ask you to start, Brian, how you got into innovation, but I want to go a layer deeper out of the gate because you and I talked about this in our pre-call and you just said it again and just a light bulb went off. You talked about you're responsible for innovation inside the company and outside the company. So will you help me understand how you see the difference in those two and how they, I don't know, maybe complement each other or actually how they integrate as well?
Well, I think a lot of it actually comes back to how I got into kind of this corporate innovation space in the first place. So I started more on the startup side of things. So about 8 years ago, I started EndMotion, which was the first startup accelerator program based in Nebraska, raised a little mini angel fund and brought together a bunch of mentors and a program and started investing at early stage software technology kind of companies. And through that particular process and learning and teaching new methodologies like Lean Startup and customer discovery and that, really started, you know, kind of building this ecosystem around innovation and startups. And I kept getting asked by corporations, how is this happening? How are companies moving so fast? How can I get in touch with them? How can I build that relationship? And so I spun up Inside Outside as a way to kind of help tell those stories and build that community, build that network. And so I really do believe innovation, you know, whether it's inside a company or outside a company, like in a startup, the fundamental elements are similar. You know, at the earliest stages of innovation, you're dealing with this uncertainty. And how do you create an environment where you can quickly experiment, learn, and move fast. In the case of a startup, it's before they run out of money. In the case of a corporation, you're doing different things around it, but it's still the same kind of basic functionality.
So let's talk a little bit about ideas and going nowhere, because I think that in the space of innovation, whether you're looking outside in or inside out, right, there's this challenge that no matter how many channels you have for innovation or for ideas, they sometimes tend to go nowhere. So I know we're going to flip it and talk about the solution, but before we do that, will you talk a little bit about what you think keeps them stuck?
Yeah. So I think it's a little bit different for startups versus like a corporation. I think a lot of times when I'm working with corporate teams, they a lot of times jump to the 93rd item on the list. So they get stuck because they start thinking about, well, how am I going to scale this? Or this is going to be, how is this going to give me $10 billion of revenue in the next 3 weeks kind of stuff? Where a lot of times you have to really say, okay, that is a problem. We may encounter that problem if we solve all these other problems in front of it. But it gets stuck because it's looking too far out in the future versus what's the immediate thing we have to learn right now that gets us traction that we can then move to the next step, that we can then move to the next step. So I think that's one thing that slows down innovation or stops ideas from moving.
Yeah.
Secondly, I think really about how do you think about 10x behavior. You know, ideas stop because they're too marginal or too incremental. And it's not that those can't solve problems and can't be important, but like thinking at least out of the box, like how big could this get, or what would it take to get a 10x result, will give you a better chance of getting traction than that if you can solve those types of problems.
So I want to share a story with you, Brian, and then I would love for you to help me break it down of how it should have been. I've been through this experience. Like, I know what we did wrong or what happened wrong, but I think this is actually a really good case study for you to springboard off of and share a little bit about how you keep it from getting too incremental, number one, because that's a problem in itself. And number two, how you don't go 1 to 93. Right. I love the way you said that, because I think that's so true. Like, we go from the conference room to $10 million launch and we're like, I don't know what went wrong here. Hey, like, why is this a problem? So early on in my career, the short of it is I was working on a joint venture between a European brand and White Wave Foods, so Silk Soy Milk. And it was called Fruit to Go. And it was apple juice and single serve, so it makes sense. Yep. Until you add the fact that it had bits of apple in it, which for European consumers made sense from a behavior. From American consumers, that's a new behavior for us. We don't tend to eat our drinks, right? That's new for us. So the challenge we had is, first of all, the milestones and the benchmarks of success that we put on it were the same as the established brands. And then we didn't hit them. Shocking, right? Right. And the second thing, so we went from 1 to 93, like, oh, once we launch this, the trial should be this and the money should be this, right?
Right.
And I think that's kind of what you're alluding to. The second thing we did is, I fought this. I just want to say in my defense, I fought it, but I did not win. Is we actually tried to minimize its differentiating point so that people wouldn't be afraid. Where I kind of felt like we should have owned it, right? Like, we should have been like, hey, there's bits of apple in this. If you want that, this is for you. If you don't, this is not for you, right? So we watered it down and almost made it incremental because that felt safer to everybody. Now, needless to say, the entire thing failed. So I would love for you to break down for me like what you hear in that and how we should have done it differently.
Well, a couple things come to mind. I think a lot of people think about, especially early entrepreneurs, they think about the biggest vision that they have, and but they oftentimes don't realize like that is the big vision. You should think about that, where you're going to go or where you could be. But at the earliest stages, it doesn't matter. Like you've got to find that early adopter that really has that core pain point that you can really work with, and you can solve that pain point for that person so that they can actually start building a solution that works for them. And then they can tell their friends and they can tell their friends and kind of grow it from that place. I mean, if you think about most of the major startups that we know of today, whether it's, Facebook or Airbnb or Uber or whatever, they didn't start out owning the complete space. You know, Facebook started like as, hey, we're going to have some for Harvard.
A conference center or something, right?
Yeah. So Facebook is Harvard. And then it's like, okay, we worked and we understood and we built that out. Now we're going to go to the Ivy schools. Okay. And then that worked and they'll go for the other schools. And then eventually they got to a place where let's launch the public, the general public. So that's one thing. It's like really trying to understand who's that early adopter core person who has that pain point that you can experiment with.
Yeah.
And then I think also just around how do you not like you were talking about metrics, like the metrics that you use at the earliest stages of innovation are totally different than an existing business model that you are optimizing for.
Yeah.
You know, at the earliest stages,
you have the wrong ones.
You don't have a business model. You don't have, you don't know who the customer is. You don't know exactly what the product is.
Right.
And so to measure it against those types of measurements, you're naturally going to fall down. Like you're saying, like, but why are we not hitting these metrics? Well, because you're solving a different problem. You're at a different stage.
Right. Because the metrics are making sense. That's why.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What then do you suggest are, and it doesn't have to be specific, but if you were to think about like that 1 through 10 steps, mm-hmm. what types of metrics do you think are more appropriate to your point when you don't have a business model? And again, I think I just want to highlight for everybody listening, this is for a startup, but that's also for a big company. Like when you're launching a new brand or a new line or a new service or a new even initiative inside, you don't have a business model yet. You really don't. You think you do because you have other past experiences in other brands,
right.
but you really don't. So what do you, Brian, think is the right way to measure at the beginning?
Yeah. So I look to, you know, people who experiment and done a lot of this work, David Bland or Alexander Osterwalder, who have talked about this. But, you know, you really have three things that you're trying to test with a business model at the earliest stages. You're trying to see, is it desirable? Is there a desirability factor? Like, does somebody actually want this problem solved? Then is it feasible? Can we actually build something that can solve that problem? And then is it viable? You know, can we make money at this? Or is this the right thing for us to be doing at this time? And I think a lot of people jump to like the feasibility. Can we build this?
Right.
Versus most business models and most things fall down because of lack of desirability. You know, at the end of the day, I think if you're going to look at that business model canvas, you want to spend most of your time up front on that right side of the business model canvas, which is all about who's the customer, what's the value proposition, how am I going to deliver that for them versus who are my partners and how am I going to make money at it and that. Because if you don't have that core need solved at the beginning, the rest of the business model by default will probably fall down.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that's why so many ideas fail in the beginning? It's just wrong metrics? Or I guess there's two ways to ask this question. One is, do they stop momentum because we're looking at the wrong things up front? So we kill them too early. And, or is it because we jump ahead to 93 and we've missed everything that would optimize the idea before we do that?
I don't know if there's one answer to that. I think the thing we often also overlook is the fact that innovation and starting new things is hard. I mean, if you just look at it, you know, the best in the world, the venture capitals in the world, they can't pick the ideas at the beginning and they know which ones are going to be the winners. You know, you just can't do it. So it's hard to go from zero to 1,000. That's why most companies don't make it. And so I think oftentimes we don't allow ourselves the fact that this idea may be crap and that's okay. It may fail, but the key is having enough others in the back funnel to say, okay, well, this is, you know, cause you get a better cadence in that. If you can get out of the mindset of like, this has got to work versus let's see if this works. And if it doesn't, I've got something else I can throw off the shelf and try to make that work.
Right.
So I think that's another key element of this whole thing.
So I'm going to ask the question that like, I think is the elephant in the room around innovation. But I think it's an important one, which is how do you know when it's time to put it into Davy Jones' locker, right?
Yeah.
Into the grave. Like, it's not the right idea. I think, you know, we always hear persistence. And I don't disagree with that, right? Tweak it, edit it, evolve it. Like, every step is a learning step and you might figure it out along the way. But there are some ideas that are not right now, should be killed for whatever reason. Doesn't mean they're bad, but it means they're not right now. So How do you gauge whether you're giving up too early versus like that one needs to go in the graveyard for a while?
So some of it, I think, is looking at what walls are you running up against? You know, again, are you running up against the walls that no one seems to care about this? Or if they do care about it, it's item number 9 on their list of priorities to try to solve versus we're going to stop it because we can't figure out how to make this little widget work right. You know, and so trying to understand what wall you're running up against, I think, is a good signal. And then also looking at like, what are the alternatives? Like if we shelve it now, is there something else in the backlog that we have more confidence in? And I think the third thing is looking at what are you actually measuring it against? So a lot of projects keep going forward because it's the pet project, or we need to keep it going because we've already put money into it, versus like, what's the evidence really showing us? Yeah. And making sure that we're making realistic bets based on what the evidence in the market showing us, not what we hope to be happening or what the boss says we should continue to push forward.
So I just want to, I'm going to share a personal professional story on that, because I think you just highlighted something that's really important for all of us to hear, which is sometimes we keep it going because like we're personally attached to it, right? Or we've invested time and energy and we don't want to let it go. And I will tell you on a professional level, I had one of my team members working on it was basically like a CRM type system for us. And over time, not CRM, that's not the right way to say it, but anyway, it's a technology system, like Excel spreadsheet thing. And over time, it just wasn't the right thing to do. But when I said we need to shift and like start from scratch and do something else, they were so offended and disappointed. And I get it, right? Just personally, I spent so much time and energy. But it wasn't because she believed in the idea. It was because she had invested a lot of time and it just wasn't what it needed to be. Now, I mean, before I kind of let it go, I just want to give you one personal story that one of my sons would kill me for sharing. Let me tell you, because I actually think it highlights what you're saying. My 16-year-old got in trouble for what I thought was cheating at school. Turned out he wasn't the one who cheated. Someone cheated off him, but he got like, at first it was like all the alarms go off. Right. And I'd come up with this whole grounding concoction in my head of like, no friends, no technology for the rest of school year. It's all school. And then it came out over 48 hours that he's not the one that cheated off. He made a mistake by sharing some information, but he didn't like in any way have mount tent. But in my head, I was like, I still need to ground him because I'd gotten so attached to that, to that mindset, right? But I think that those two stories are exactly what you're talking about, which is we get so personally involved with things that we can't detach ourselves. Like I had to really think back and go, wait a minute, am I grounding him because I got invested in that as an outcome, or am I grounding him because that's what should happen, right? Of course, it's not what should happen. So,
and I think the other thing, like in the corporate environment, the difference between like corporates and startups in the corporate environment, you can't fail. Like you're not allowed to. So like you keep pushing forward because it's like, I'm not allowed to fail. Or if I do fail, what's my job? What's the next thing that's going to happen? It's a mark against me. Versus in the startup realm, like if you go into the valley and you've failed a company, so to speak,
like whatever,
there's 25 others in line that you could probably jump on or do a part of. So it's that, how do you create an environment that it's okay to not fail because of incompetence, but fail because like the idea wasn't the right time or the idea didn't work because of XYZ.
Do you think it's that fear of failure or being wrong, right? Or that lack of a system that actually allows for failure that forces us to get so personally attached to the road that we're on?
I think that's part of it. I think all of it, a lot of it also is just the nature of business. Again, a lot of times we fund projects and we keep funding it because it's part of the budget cycle or whatever. Yeah. And so it's like, we'll just, you know, it comes back every year and it's like, well, it's made some progress. Well, let's just keep funding it for another year versus being more prescriptive around it and saying, okay, what did we need to learn in this X time period, a year, 3 months, 6 months, whatever the case is. And where are we at versus what we thought we were going to be at? And does that warrant additional resources, time, money, effort for the next series of bets of learnings that we have to push?
And being okay saying it doesn't.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So by the way, Brian,
you've got to have a way to redeploy those people, or you are going to have an environment where it's like, if your idea doesn't work and you're out on the street after that, no one's going to be taking big risks to be on that conveyor belt.
Right. Well, and I think that failure is one of those unfortunate things that gets a lot of lip service of we love failure, fail fast, fail forward, right? Like failure's okay. We reward failure at our company. But if you actually look at the behaviors in the system, the opposite is happening. So people know they should do it one way, but I don't think most of them do, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very difficult because, I mean, again, if you think fundamentally about business models and where an existing company is, they have gotten there because they figured out a business model and they're optimizing for it and it's working. And that's everything should be going towards that way. Everything should be rewarded in that way. They're hiring for those types of people. So it's very difficult to have that ambidextrous kind of environment.
Yeah. So I just got a question in that I want to make. So if you see me looking down, I'm looking at questions, my notes, just so you know, my phone. So I got a question in on the Q&A bar that I want to bring up. I want to add, because I think it's an important one. So this is coming from one of our online academy members. Their question is, how do you shift your leadership's mindset around failure if you're in that trap you just talked about?
Yeah. So a couple of things that we've tried that are, again, it's a work in progress. But I think reframing how you take on these experiments and that. So even taking on, like, we're not launching a brand new product or whatever. Hey, we're running an experiment, or this is a side project that we're going to, where we don't know if it's going to work, but you're framing it in such a way like, hey, this is an experiment. We're going to see if this works. And here's what we're going to try to learn in this particular thing. And we'll get back to you when we learn that and let you know how it goes. That's much different versus saying we are launching a brand new product and it's going to work or not going to work. Out of the gate. So if you frame it as experiments, if you frame it as here's the learning chunk that we're going to try to learn right now, and here's what we're going to do to get to that, and then here's the evidence that we've received through that particular process, I think that's easier. It frames failure in a slightly different way. It frames it as learning versus failure.
Yeah, I like that. And I like the idea of setting up the expectation. I don't want to say you're minimizing expectations. That's not right. But you are changing the expectations on the front end to not get attached to it on the back end yet.
Yes. Like, we don't know where this is going. Here's our assumptions as of the date and time right now. And this is, we think, is the riskiest part of those assumptions that we need to test first. Because if this doesn't hold true, then the rest of the business model is not going to work. Or we'll have to pivot and change it. But if you're upfront with that and transparent with that and more systematic about that, I think, it's very, very hard to do that. But two, if you get into that cadence and you get into that particular process, I think it's easier to then be able to say yay or nay to an idea, or let's keep it going, or let's try something else.
Well, and you just said something that I think is critical. So I want to back up, Brian, and just dig into a little bit. You said, like, hey, we're running an experiment, right? Test, these are assumptions. And this is a part that I thought, like, to me was a really aha moment, was these are the things we need to test to make sure this is even worth pursuing, or that I can't remember exactly how you said it. And I was too busy going, oh, to remember the exact words. But basically you're saying, like, here are the critical things we need to find out on the front end. How do you help clients or in your company, how do you help them figure out what those critical things are? Because I would say that oftentimes, in fact, I'll give you an example. I have a colleague who's in healthcare. He's an administrator at a really large healthcare system. One of the things he was telling me the other day is he gets frustrated because they look at so many data points, or so they try to solve so many questions at once that it actually paralyzes them. He's been trying to pare down of, like, what are the top five things we need to know to actually make a decision and move forward. So how do you think about that?
Yeah, I think this is something entrepreneurs struggle with too, is because if you think about it, at the earliest stages, there is so much you can do. I mean, you can work on problems all over the board. And so the best entrepreneurs, I think, are the ones that try to figure out, how do I prioritize all the different things I could be working on, all the things I have to learn to make this enterprise work? What are the critical things that I need to learn in the next 2 hours, in the next 3 weeks, in the next 4 months, whatever the case may be? And so there's a couple of different examples that I've used in the past. David Bland has a great way to kind of map, he calls it assumption mapping, but he basically talks about, first of all, on post-it notes, you can map out all the assumptions about the business model that you have. And then you want to place that on a grid based on how impactful is that particular assumption to the business, and how much do I know about it? Like, how confident am I that this assumption is true? And if you start mapping out your assumptions on that, on those kind of gradients, you'll start finding the ones in the upper right quadrant are the ones that are critical to the business, and the ones I don't know much about. And you can use that as a, again, it's not 100% perfect. You're just trying to get directionally, like, what are the two or three things that I probably should be spending my time digging into? And again, at the earliest stages, it's usually around customers. It's usually around the pain points that they have. Right. And trying to understand how difficult is it, and are they willing to pay to have that value created?
So one of the things that I've heard you talk about, I think you mentioned on the panel and in our discussion, was around, like, this, and I've talked about this in a different way, which is around, like, getting a real culture of experimentation and a methodology around that versus a couple rogue people who are really good at it. And then everybody else is like, no, like, let's not do that. But I know you've developed a method to help companies really embrace that in a way that works for them. Will you talk a little bit about how that works?
Yeah. So we're experimenting with some different ways. Again, part of it is cultural. You know, how do you change the culture so that people can raise their hand and say, hey, I want to be an entrepreneur, or I have an idea. I've got a problem that I've seen that I think I can solve. How do you first enable them to do that? And then what's the process so that you can help them to figure out so they don't go down the wrong path, or they don't waste resources they don't need to. So we've kind of tried to use almost a constraint process. So it's like, what can we figure out in a certain amount of time with a certain amount of resources that, again, identifies the core areas that we need to learn, and then what's next in that particular process? So we call it 2-3-4. The first process is, if you have an idea, you can raise your hand and you're basically granted 2 hours to map that particular idea out. You know, who's the problem? Who has the problem? What's the customer? What's the value proposition? What are my gut basis for this? Why I think this is interesting. And in that 2 hours, not only do you kind of map it out, but you also then are tasked with circulating that around. Just get some feedback from other folks within your team.
So kind of, it's where a little bit of experimentation of like where the rubber meets the road. What do you think?
And you're testing it. And so you're saying first of all, I think too many people keep their ideas close to the vest, and they don't want to launch until it's perfect. We're saying like, hey, in 2 hours, get it on paper and then start talking to people, because other people have insights that you may not have. And so in that 2 hours, if you can talk to a couple of people, you've mapped out your idea, you can start get some early signals like, hey, there's something here. You know, maybe we should spend a couple more hours, a couple more days to figure out what's next. And so with that 2 hour block, that's the constraint. And then you basically take it to your boss or to a decision board, and they say, yes, this is something that we are going to invest a little bit more time and resources. And then you go to the three bucket. And the three bucket is 3 days. Again, short amount of time. In the 3 days, you map out the business model. You start identifying some early customer discovery questions that you want to ask. But again, it's in a very short amount of time. It's like, how fast can you move this idea forward in 3 days to give us more confidence at the end of that 3 days that we should invest more time and money? At the end of the three, you go to four, and then that's when it's like 4 weeks. And again, the numbers are fungible. You know, it may be a little bit more or less.
It's about the method, not the specifics of it. Yeah,
exactly. And then at the 4 week, that's maybe when you get another person on your team, and you can maybe develop a prototype, or you start doing some mapping of an interface, or again, additional customer discovery interviews. But this process gets you in the cadence of, what do we have to learn? Is there evidence that we learned it? What's the next thing we have to learn? And each time you're doubling down and giving them a little bit more slack, giving them a little bit more resources to move the ball down the table. And then after that, it's very much like a venture capital kind of bet, where at some point it becomes a startup with a team, and then that team gets to identify my seed investor, and then they make progress and they go back to get their Series A, Series B, Series D, etc.
So, do you think that, how do I ask this question? It's like jumbled in my head right now. Yeah. I also would imagine that the other thing I love about this process is, so I love that it lays out a way to build experimentation that is easy to follow or easy to stick to. And I don't mean that like we're dumb and we can't follow a method. I mean it more like it's so easy to fall back on the incremental, or to get out of experimentation and all the mistakes we talked about in the beginning. So I love that. The other thing is on the CEO side of this conversation, I love that if I give you 2 hours and you don't do anything with it, that's on you. And it means that you didn't actually have the energy or the effort. So I think the other thing I hear from a lot of leaders, which is like a catch-22, is like, I want all these ideas, but now I'm inundated with ideas. Is it nobody, like, they throw the ball over the fence and then they're like backing up, right? So
that's exactly right. I mean, we fall into this trap, and I've seen other companies fall into this trap where it's like they create an innovation hub or something outside, and then people throw their innovations over there, and it's like somebody else will handle innovation.
Yeah, and they're like flooded with ideas. Yeah,
exactly. Well, and then that team may or may not have the domain expertise. They may not have the passion around it. They may not know the nuances that the person who originally came up with the idea has. And it also, it goes back to that forcing function. What, like, if you don't care enough about this to spend 2 hours to convince other people or to map it out, then that's a pretty big signal that it's not an idea we want to bet right now on.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I would assume somewhere along, let's say I'm the one with the idea, I spend my 2 hours, right? I get to the next step. Maybe somewhere along the way, it's better served if somebody else takes the lead because of where we are in the process. Can you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's oftentimes what happens. And especially in a corporation, it's not always because the person's not right to handle and move that idea forward, but maybe they just like doing the optimization job that they are good at and want to continue doing that. And they just wanted to, you know, shepherd that to a point where someone else can take the ball and run with it. But I think at the earliest stages, it's important to have one person who's kind of accountable for that next stage and what's required in the next stage and what's the next bet to be placed.
Okay, I got another question for you. So this just came in from another Academy member on my little Q&A bar. So the question is, I have many ideas I want to pursue, but I'm not sure which one. Can I apply the 2 hours to 10 ideas and see which one goes furthest first, or do I have to start with one?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's any like proven methodology. Like if you do this, you're going to be successful. Even if, lean startup and everything else, even if you followed everything in lean startup, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have a successful company or business. But I do think you can do a couple different things. And I work with, this oftentimes is a similar puzzle when I get a company or a team that says, hey, we can go and look at these 5 different customer segments, you know, and they're all different. Which one should we pursue first? And so it becomes like mapping out. And again, you can use different criteria, but like map out all the particular customer segments and then figure out, okay, well, who's more likely to be able to buy this? Which customer segments can I quickly get in front of to have some customer discovery calls with? Which ones am I passionate about working with or spending time with? You can kind of map it out and then map out those particular ones and see if there's ones that rise to the top. And then that can give you, again, it's not necessarily meant to be the be all end all, but to give you direction, give you something that you can then take the next action on. Because I think that's the most important thing. It really doesn't probably matter which one you pick one, and get evidence and keep moving forward. Too many people get paralysis of analysis and they don't pick any of them. So it's like, take some criteria, map it out the best you can with your gut, and with your resources, and then pick one and see where, if you're on the right track.
Well, I think as a team, if all of you are mapping it out, you'll figure out the right direction. You know, I love that question because I will tell you, in our academy in particular, I am constantly saying quantity over quality at the gate at front. Because to your point, right, about, I think oftentimes we move forward with one idea because it's all we have. So we need quantity on the front end so that we don't fall in love, right, with the wrong. And quantity gets to quality. So there was this study done by a photography professor, half the class graded on quality of photo, right? Lighting, composition. I'm not a photographer, but you know what I mean? And the other side was quantity. And what he found at the end was the students who were graded on quantity actually had better composition than those graded on who were told they needed quality, because obviously they were out there experimenting, trying, seeing what works, right? Where these guys were so focused on the right picture that it really actually hindered their ability to do a good job.
Yeah, you learn a lot by just going out there and find and experimenting in the marketplace.
Yeah.
So even if you pick the wrong customer segment, you learn pretty quickly, hey, that's the wrong customer segment. We have a list back at the office that has 3 other ones that we can go after. Let's kill that. Let's say that particular customer segment is not the one we want to pursue right now. Let's pick the other one off the board and go and see if we can move that forward too.
You know, it's interesting. Years ago, I was working with Procter & Gamble. They had a disruptive hair care. They used to have the disruptive innovation team, and I was working with them with this disruptive hair care product. And we created these mock-ups. It was basically highlighting at home. It's the best way to describe it. And we created these mock-ups, and we rented kiosks in the middle of a mall that we thought had the right target audience. And it was fascinating. Nobody would talk to us. So it was fascinating to realize that our first foot forward, forget the product, we couldn't even talk about the product in a way that anybody cared about. to get them to even tell them about the product. But doing, to your point about rubber meets the road, doing that made us realize that, like, before we even finalize the product, we need to figure out who we were speaking to and what their real problem was, because we had gotten it so wrong.
Absolutely.
It was so insightful.
Yeah. And again, that evidence that you get from the marketplace, when you go back to the CEO and say, hey, this is why it failed, and you can point to, here's who we talked to, or here's why it didn't work, versus we spent 3 weeks in a conference room and we think this is why it's not working. It's a different type of conversation you have.
Yeah. Oh my God, Brian, you're totally speaking my language on that, because I really fundamentally believe that if you want to get your ideas moved forward, you got to show them initiative and what you've done and why, right? Like, here is the proof, right? People talk to us, or here's the proof and here's what we have to learn. It is so much more compelling than just, here's a PowerPoint presentation with some potential.
And it takes the burden off of you having to be right. Cause it's like, I'm not right. It's like, the market is telling me this, you know, this is the evidence that we're pooling. It's not like my opinion is right or wrong. It's like, this is the reality of the situation. So it's that failure. It's like, not me as person who threw the experiment out as the failure. It's like that assumption was wrong.
Right.
You to try the next assumption.
I feel like you just threw down a huge insight bomb around, you're right. Like, I'd never really thought of it that way. And so for all of us in Launch Street and in the Academy, like, really pay attention to that. The experiment not only helps you learn things and really it's the right way to move forward, but also it takes the pressure off of you of all your inside insights have to be right. Right. So, and you're right. And I think actually that insecurity and that fear holds us back because we're supposed to have all the answers. And what you're saying is no, when you experiment, the market tells us what's right and what's wrong. It's not about us.
Right. Yeah, you can point to something else, some actual test that you ran, and it's much easier to look at that number objectively versus, I don't like this guy's opinion, so I'm not gonna bet on it.
Oh my God, that was amazing! Thank you for that. Okay, I wanna flip gears a little bit because a couple things you said have sparked this question in me, which is, you know, oftentimes I find that if you go into a company and whether it's a Nelnet or, like, you know, someone else. And I don't think this is true in startups because they're so lacking in hierarchy at that point. But, you know, when you talk to leadership, they have one view on how innovation is going in their company. And then you talk to the front lines, whatever that looks like, whether that's out in the field or just, you know, in the office, right, in the cubes, and they have a very different view of innovation. And oftentimes it's that cross wires that keeps them from innovating. So as a director of innovation and a large company, and you guys have a lot going on in a lot of industries, how do you think about making sure that everybody's actually on the same page? Because I think when you talk to people, leadership thinks frontline is on the same page and frontline thinks whatever they're saying is obvious to leadership, but it doesn't seem to usually be the case.
Yeah, I think first of all, it's defining innovation. So, you know, kind of getting on a level framework of what that even is, because I think when we hear the word innovation, it's so watered down in that, you know, part of what we're trying to do is, like, culturally, like, innovation doesn't mean you have to create the next Twitter or Uber. Like, we're not asking everybody to do that. Most people can't come up with that. And we're not asking for that. But
so innovation is exhausting.
Yeah. Innovation itself, though, can be as simple as core innovation, which is, how do we work with our existing customers, with our existing products to make it better, faster, cheaper, whatever, and solving those problems that we know exist in our existing stuff, making that better and optimizing for that. Those are a lot of easy, really innovative wins and ways you can continue to funnel wins into the innovation and get you continually funded in that is by finding those easy wins and making sure that people understand that that's innovation. So telling those stories. One of the things we do at Nelnet is we have something, it's a monthly thing called Spark. And our job is to kind of curate some of the projects that are not being told or maybe not told across all of the organizations and give them a highlighting place to talk about that. So once a month, we have this thing called Spark. All the directors and above can come to it. And we pick somebody to get on stage for 15 minutes to talk about a new project, a new innovation, a new something that they're building. And then again, this is across the entire organization. So what we found is not only does it just expand people's knowledge of what's going on within the company, but it's allowed for a lot more collaboration to take place. So it's like, hey, you guys are working on this. It's not in our industry, but I have got somebody over here that might be able to help from a technology perspective. Right. Or, hey, have you thought about what you're doing over here and how that might apply to our side of the business? And we found that we've been doing it about 2 years right now, once a month. And if nothing else, it identifies some of those curious, restless folks, because we can track, like, who's coming to these meetings. And we know that those are the types of people that are more likely to be, you know, innovative thinkers.
Yeah.
And then again, it also allows for collaboration, cross-pollinization of what's going on as well.
You know, it's interesting. So I did a speaking engagement, some other work for a company called Schneider Electric. We have someone in our academy on from them. They're a great company. And I can't share the specifics, obviously, but what I can tell you, the one thing I was really impressed by when I went to this meeting is before me, they had an awards thing. And they were rewarding people for innovation and hard work, but they didn't have them come up and speak about the outcome. They had them come up and speak about the process they went through to figure out that solution, win that new client, you know, whatever it was. And I remember being standing in the back, being blown away by that flip in an award ceremony. Because always it's like that person brought in $100 million. That person landed a new client. That person solved a problem. But it wasn't that. It was the process itself. Yeah. It was so cool.
And we've had that at our Spark as well, where we brought on a project that failed. And it's like, tell us what you learned from launching this particular thing. And that is one of the hardest buckets to find in the organization. Because again, it's that natural tendency to not want to talk about your failure, especially in a corporation, but to find those nuggets and say, hey, it's okay. We are purposely trying to highlight the fact that we tried something that didn't work and we learned this much from it. And the fact that you failed here allowed us to do this later on.
Yeah.
Those are huge wins. But it's over time. It doesn't happen overnight. And it's something you got to keep practicing.
Well, and to your point, I think, and really it's part of this whole conversation, if you're experimenting, those failures aren't $100 million failures because you figured it out before you got there. I mean, I think that's part of the problem with going and why failure is hard. Because if we go from step one to, as you said, step 93, right? Yeah. Of course, right? The failure is really big at step 93. So, you know, we feel that $100 million or, you know, whatever it is bigger. I got a couple more questions for you. And I just want to remind on the Academy, those who have the privilege of listening, and if you've got a question, now's your chance, because we're going to kind of have to, I could keep going because this is so insightful, but in the essence of time, we're going to have to wrap it up. But I want to say, Brian, before I ask these questions, that what I love about what you're saying is I feel like it applies to me in a medium-sized business, small business, a solopreneur, a startup, but also really big companies. Like it really isn't an either or. Like, you have to be in this type of company or size to benefit from experimentation. And I would actually argue for large companies that the beauty for them is they actually have more space to experiment because they have more room to figure stuff out. Where when you're in a startup, you're not only figuring it out, but like the impact of that is immediate. You know, I mean, I know that like every time I make a change to my website, it's immediate and there's a reason immediately and I need the result to be immediately, you know? Where in a large company, you have a little bit more bandwidth to actually explore, I think.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, my thesis is that we're all going to have to be much more entrepreneurial. If you think about, you know, the half-life of your skills that you learned in college, I think I read somewhere like the traditional engineering degree, it used to be if you got out of engineering school, you'd have a 4-year runway of your skills being relevant. And I think it's now a year and a half.
Yeah.
And that's
actually good.
Yeah. And that's in every category. And so If the default is going to be constant change and the default is going to be, you have to be much more adaptable, much more resourceful, much more resilient. What are the skill sets that you can learn now that are going to come into play that next disruption that happens? Because it's going to happen. We just don't know exactly. I mean, I think COVID's a great example of the fact that now, for the last 5 years, I've been talking about disruption and now people kind of get it. It's not just a theoretical.
I was laughing the other day. I was speaking at an engagement live, if you can believe it. And I said, listen, here's the deal in my business. We used to say disrupt or be disrupted, innovate or die. And I don't think it was really true until 2020.
Yeah.
You know, where like it was, oh my God, shit is changing, you know, like right now. And I think people could rest on their success a little more. I think they would hit the cliff or the decline inevitably. Like, they needed to innovate, but that disruption thing was not as urgent, I think it is today. So I'm glad you brought that up.
It wasn't pervasive. It wasn't pervasive. It was in pockets. And now it was like literally overnight. What are we going to do with 6,000 employees? We need to get them working remotely.
Right. It was kind of industry business based, not global. Yeah, right.
To the family, to the home, to the whatever. Yeah.
Everything. Yeah. So that brings me to my next question, which is, and it's a little bit of an obvious one, but I don't like to be assumptive. So why do you think, just given what you were just saying even, and how do you think about innovation? Like, why is it so important right now? I think it's something, again, we all give a lot of lip service to, especially right now, but how do you see that?
So again, the thesis that I have is that, and the data shows it. I mean, the lifespan of a S&P 500 company has gone from 60 years down to 12 and a half. Yeah. And so that's not going to change. The things that are hitting at the same time. I think that's really one of the keys. So you've got technologies, you know, where, whether it's AI, self-driving cars, you name the 25 technologies that you have in your head right now, any one of those are significantly disruptive, and yet they're all hitting at once.
Yeah.
You add on the access to capital that's never been there before, so you can spin up an idea overnight. The tools that are available that, you know, I'm not a developer, but I can pretty much develop a tech company tomorrow, or over a weekend, and you know, $1,000 in my pocket. That wasn't possible, you know, back in the day. And so the ability to test and build and experiment has never been easier. So those pressures, the technology pressures, the access to markets. I mean, think about it. Like, again, access to Twitter or Facebook, these other platforms that allow you to find customers around the world that are early adopters into your whatever your niche is.
Yeah.
That's never been available before. And so all these things are hitting at the same time. So because of that, again, things are going to be disruptive. We don't know exactly where it's going to, you know, come out. But because of that, I believe that you have to start learning some of the skill sets of an entrepreneur. You have to learn exploration. You've got to be able to build a network of people and collaborators around that. And then I think probably one of the biggest keys is, like, how do you move faster? How do you actually act on some of this kind of stuff and you know, test things, build things, try things? That's I think are the people that can do those types of skill sets or get mastery in those kind of areas are the ones that are going to be better positioned for whatever happens in the future.
So if I have gotten a little bit bogged down by the structure, systems, habits, behaviors, right, whatever that's kept me from maybe exploring and experimenting, what do you recommend is a tiny baby step that I can do to at least start to get in that direction?
Yeah. So the first thing I say is maybe start exploring outside your industry. Start just reading about other industries. I think that's where a lot of people fall into the first immediate trap. It's like they get so focused in what they're doing and the things that they're supposed to be doing and the people they're supposed to be competing against and that. And they get very well known and they understand that really well. So the first thing is, like, pick an industry that's not related. Yeah. And then you can start seeing compatible. Well, what if I took that idea from this industry and brought it over here? How would that affect what I'm doing?
I love that.
So, you know, exposing yourself to new ideas. I think the other thing is really building a network. It's like, how do you build connections and collisions with people outside of your normal everyday environment so that you can bounce ideas off of them and start building that network of folks that of other skill sets, because eventually you're going to be at a point where you probably need to pull on other people's expertise in that. So the quicker you can start building that network, the better off as well.
You know, I'll tell you, one of my favorite things to do is to talk to people who know nothing about my industry. Because I think that they have a perspective that I just, even if it's not, I don't want to say fully valid, I don't mean it that way, but they don't have all the information, but it's just enough naive intelligence to make me see a gap I didn't see before. By the way, I just want to say that Paul, who was joining us from our academy, says, many thanks, Brian. And tomorrow it's evening time here. Yeah, he's over. Yes. I think he's over in London. But he says lots of new insights. So I just want to make sure I got that to you. Awesome. So I want to add to that and just say that one of the other things I think is important that we do is when we see those things that make us go, huh, to actually stop and explore them. So I'm going to give you a quick example from this morning. Actually, I've been seeing this thing for the Clubhouse, every now and again on Facebook. In all truth, I was ignoring it. I was busy, right? So I did the opposite of what I'm saying to do. And then I got a text from a girlfriend who just started a podcast, another Launch Streeter, and was like, hey, have you heard of Clubhouse? I have an invite for you if you want it. And I was like, what is this thing? So I went on, I did the app while I was doing my hair this morning. I went into Clubhouse, and there's all these conversations happening in this Clubhouse. And I was like, well, this is fascinating. But I think it's those moments where something keeps catching our attention. And most of the time we tend to brush it off because it's not in our zone, right? Or it's not in our field of vision. But I think, to your point about applying, I'm trying to figure out what's happening in Clubhouse so that I can apply that to what we do.
Absolutely. One of the things that I do, and so to make it kind of part of my job, is I curate a newsletter. So I wake up every morning and I spend about the first half hour to hour calling through hundreds of newsletters and different feeds that I have to figure out the 10 best that I want to have in the newsletter every week. And I find, and I purposely pick items that are not always the same. So there's stuff around innovation that, but I'll throw in some things around construction or I don't know, whatever kind of fits my fancy in that. And then I push that out to folks. And then that starts building a cycle loop as well, because then I get feedback from those folks saying, hey, this is a great article. Or have you seen this about that particular area?
One, yeah.
And so I find for me, it's not only keeps me up to date, but then it also allows me to start building that network and that around that. So that's one way that I've done that. The other thing is obviously the podcast, and you probably aren't very much aware of this, of how that opens up conversations you didn't have before. Yeah. So you know, for 5 years, we've had a weekly podcast, and you know, everybody from, you know, the who's, I just talked to Rita McGrath yesterday, and she's going to be on the podcast, and Alexander Osterwalder, and some of these names that from a little, you know, place in Lincoln, Nebraska, probably wouldn't necessarily get to have those conversations. But by again, building something and then throwing out to the world, you start creating these things that you couldn't expect.
Well, I think the podcast has been a fascinating channel for curiosity and exploration. So like originally I did it to bring insights to people, but what I really came to realize is I benefit just as much, because like, you just opened my eyes to things I hadn't thought about in that way before. And I love it. And I think listening to podcasts, it kind of gives you the same thing. I love to listen to podcasts that are in real estate and like direct marketing, like things that I'm not directly linked to, because I don't know, it's just a whole different conversation that they're having. Brian, before we go, where do you want people to go to connect with you, listen to your podcast? We'll make sure to put those links in the show notes.
Yeah. So I'm happy to link in on LinkedIn, Twitter at Artinger. And then of course you can go to our website, insideoutside.io. That's got our access to the newsletter, access to all the podcasts and everything else we put out. We tend to have events that come up throughout the year, and we have an annual summit as well. We're still looking at what we're going to do in 2021, given we don't know what that's going to look like, but if you want to stay in touch, those are some ways you can do it.
So I'm going to ask you a surprising question. It's not the one I'd sent you, because I feel like we covered it. So one we used to do on our podcast and we walked away from, I might bring it back, which is this. What's one thing we'd be surprised to learn about you? Like a hobby, a passion, like not the typical work, something else.
Yeah. I'm living in Lincoln, Nebraska, but I've lived in Hong Kong for and worked in Asia Pacific for probably seven to 10 years out of my life. That's one interesting kind of tidbit. I think the other thing is my background has been really a series of experiments and trying to figure out like, what's that next trend? What's that next thing? And so whether it was, building a consulting practice with Gartner Group in the mid 90s back in Asia, when the internet was first starting to happen, to, you know, starting a venture fund with, I didn't really have any idea what a venture fund was at the time, but I thought there was something interesting around this whole startup space. And to now dealing again in the corporate innovation space and the similarities across all those particular threads, technology, transformation, talent. It's been a fun ride.
I bet it has. Well, I'm glad it landed you here with us on Inside Launch. So thank you very much, Brian. It has been, like I said, very insightful.
Well, I appreciate you having me on, and look forward to continuing the conversation. And
I'll be on your podcast next. So we'll just keep going.
Excellent.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.